Hello and welcome to another episode of Gemstone Mine. I'm John.
And I'm Alex.
And Jake is away today. Last night, he worked a long day, came home, and tried to go through the loop for resolving a Chain Veil Teferi win, and he is still working on playing through that loop right now. So we'll let you know how it goes. Until then, we're going to go back and revisit a topic we tried to record previously, and now we're going to remaster and get right this time. And we're going to talk about one of Alex's favorite possible topics.
Tribal!
Oh,
ba-dum-bum.
Yes. Ba-dum-bum! So, in talking about deck themes, themes are often going to include staple cards that make a particular theme work. Different sorts of cards might be staples in one theme and be completely unplayable outside of that theme. Like Enchantresses in, well, Enchantress. Some decks might lean more heavily into their theme, some may only include a few parts of those themes. We're going to be talking about the theme of Tribal today, but before we get to talking about Tribal, we've got some news to talk about. So Alex, we had a little bit of a, well, a big bit of a leak with Commander Legends.
Definitely. And whether or not you believe it is a conspiracy theory that Wizards of the Coast leaked them intentionally to throw off a bit of a steam at the Omnath Lucky Talent. Lucky Clover. I don't play Standard. And Into the Wilds ban. They're just like, here's some Commander spoilers. Which had a lot of cool stuff in it. The biggest one is...
I think we're going to hold off on discussing in detail any of those leaks until after we get, like, confirmation on some of them. So, since the leaks are all in German, the final English wording has not yet been determined with it. And for some of them, it may actually be relevant.
Yeah. The biggest thing with them is Planeswalker Commanders. Are they back? Are they not? I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, it seems like that is something that we will be discussing in the very near future. Well, that's the only real big news in the current world that we live in. Let's talk about any games we played since the last time we recorded together.
We have not been able to play together, unfortunately. But
no, I've mostly just been goldfishing during my downtime trying to tune a Naya Samut deck, where I'm trying to go off and combo with a Conspicuous Snoop. I'm tuning it so it's going to be somewhere around like turn 5-ish that the deck can consistently go off. It's kind of fun right now that I'm layering combos with Goblin Snoop and Kiki Jiki and that entire line, but also having the backup plan of the Unicorn from Jumpstart.
Emiel
combined with Dockside Extortionist. Because it turns out when you have a lot of ways to tutor up goblins, it is very easy to just turn around and, well, I've already got Emiel out. Might as well go get my Dockside Extortionist, get infinite mana, and then just, why not win that way?
The hardest part about that combo is actually, you know, finding an Emiel to, you know, purchase at a reasonable price.
Yeah, I did not pay a reasonable price for it, but I'm still happy to have My Little Pony.
Yeah, I've been scratching the itch playing Brawl online. It's fun. It makes it so where, like, if you were to play, like, Rogues or something, which is, you know, the new talk of town in terms of Tribal, because they got a lot of love in Zendikar. I mean, it's fun. You can play some not-so-great Rogues to some pretty interesting effects. Landfall with plant for aggressive gardening is nice. For those of you that didn't know, Ashaya, Soul of the World... stupid card.
Sure.
It is so busted. All right, but that's pretty much that. No actual EDH.
No, we're gonna fix that soon, though. I know you've been a little bit distracted with the latest boss that was released from Monster Hunter.
Yes, the black dragon that haunts my nightmares.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. We've all had our share of distractions, so we're gonna be trying to get some more games in again soon. But until then, we're going to talk about something that is, this is one of our favorite parts of Magic and Commander in particular. Let's talk Tribal, Alex.
Indeed. I'll preface this for myself. Tribal is very near and dear to me. It's what brought me into Magic. It's what brought me into EDH. There may be views or opinions or statements that I say that I firmly believe to be true. Take them at face value. They probably aren't. But I believe them. So.
I'll try to rein you in wherever I can, but this is something that we both really enjoy, so we may get a little out there with this one. But why don't we start with the basics? So when we say a tribal deck, what does that actually mean? So I'm going to read you the definition that EDHREC uses. So EDHREC, as you know, is an aggregate website where it will aggregate decks from multiple different online deck list databases, and then it'll categorize them based on the contents of that deck. So EDHREC.com categorizes a deck list as tribal if that deck has 10 or more creatures and at least 60% of them share a creature type. So at least 6 out of 10 creatures sharing a creature type. How does that work for you?
That's an incredibly loose standard to hold to EDH. Like, all right, mm-hmm. you're playing a commander deck, and excluding competitive or CEDH, which are traditionally more spell-heavy except for dorks, you're going to have more than 10 creatures in your deck. And if you're going for a tribal theme, it shouldn't be too hard for at least 6 of those 10 creatures to be on tribal point, even if you're just running mana dorks. If you run all the mana dorks that are elves, you're 90% of the way there.
Right, right. And I think when you and I were talking before the show, we kind of said that what tribal is really all about is that core concept of synergy that a lot of decks are looking for in Commander when they're trying to build up, baked into a particular creature type.
Yeah, I mean, that's all it is. It's, hey, I want to something, you know, synonymous with, because I like ramp. I like going fast. I want to take red and green and put them together. What tribes exist there? And then you've got these creature types, these tribes, that just embody the best of what those colors have to offer. And that's going to kind of start us around what we call the tribal around the color pie. Or in mm-hmm. my mental image here, is there's just that pie from the... Christmas spoiler, the Christmas promo, Naughty and Nice, and it's just surrounded by just members of all these different tribes for just a happy holiday gathering where everyone's trying to not kill one another.
Well, sitting at the white side of the table then, I think one way we can look at this would be to try to decide how have these tribes changed and evolved over time, because not all tribes are created equal. There are some tribes to actually make work as a really viable commander deck, you would be struggling. Like, if you really want to make your sponge tribal deck, that could be really difficult. But whereas other tribes, they're really, really strong and well represented. I mean, just looking at EDHREC.com, when you look at the top tribes that are out there, you see like 5,000 plus dragon decks, 4,900 plus zombie decks, 4,600 plus elf decks, 4,300 plus goblin decks.
So it's safe to say that tribal's kind of popular in Commander, right?
Tribes are definitely popular in Commander.
So it's funny, because those statements where you just said, hey, you know, these decks are represented in these numbers and all that, it gives rise to something that you may have heard in some of our other videos, and something that I firmly believe in terms of Magic, is that white generally can be one of the weakest colors on its own, but it is the strongest color to add to any other color to improve, you know, whatever game plan it wants to do. And all that basis that kind of drew me to that conclusion over the years stems from tribal. You know, hopefully we'll touch on that a bit. And
I think I know which tribe you want to talk about, but I want to save that one for later. Let's bury the lead. Let's start instead with white, and let's look at a different tribe than the one I think you're getting at. Let's start with a really simple one, and one that is fairly popular. Let's talk about soldiers, and let's talk about how this kind of tribe evolved and how it kind of represents the evolution of tribal in general. So initially, a lot of tribal was just, I have a lot of these things, I'ma get you. And the kind of iconic small white tribe is soldiers, where even from the very beginning of the game, looking back as far as sets like Alliances, where you had Kel'Doran Outpost, a way to just make lots and lots of little soldiers easily and repeatably for very little investment. It was very easy to go very, very wide. And then it wasn't really until something like the Onslaught block, Onslaught, Legion, and Scourge, where you finally started getting cards that were kind of payoffs for having a large number of soldiers on your side of the battlefield. Cards like Catapult Master. Why don't you read that one, Alex?
So Catapult Master is a bit expensive, for the time, but it is a 5 mana, 3 white-white, creature, human shoulder, no surprise there. Tap 5 untapped soldiers you control, exile target creature. There is no I in team, there is a we in weapon. fun flavor text there, and it was A33.
That was, I think that was the era of flavor text when they still had people like Mark Rosewater writing it. yeah, so at that point then, we kind of see it is a very simple threshold of just have enough soldier creatures that have a type of soldier standing on the battlefield that you can use to activate this payoff. And it's not a bad payoff. It gives you the ability to just go through and start ganking creatures. That's powerful. And potentially, you can do it to a lot of different creatures. But in terms of, like, a payoff to aim for, it's expensive. It's strong, but really, this is pretty early in when Magic was trying to do the tribal thing.
And this is back more in the terms of before tribal was like, you know, we'll talk about lords a little bit later on in terms of buffing the team, but this fit a bit more of the fantasy aspect of what Magic was at the time, where it's like, all right, so I've got my my army of soldiers on the battlefield, they're staring down this dragon, and, you know, one little soldier token versus a dragon's no match. But if I've got five soldiers and their catapult master, their captain watch, it's going to be great, and I'm going to be able to take them down. You know, my army of soldiers is going to, you know, topple this foe, and it fits the fantasy of what it is.
Right. It was definitely very strong with the flavor of what would you do when you had an army. Well, White would say this army's going to gang up and work together, and that's how they're going to eliminate their threats. It was a good early representation of what that creature was supposed to be doing. And honestly, it fit White's place in the color pie at the time.
The problem with that, and it kind of goes against the grind for what we're talking about, the evolution of, you know, tribal and the colors and whatnot, is the issue with White is it evolved, once again, in my opinion, as one of the best support colors, but tribal soldiers, or White in general, got to a point, it's like, all right, we want a lot of things on the battlefield, we want a lot of board presence, great, and then we're going to give you a bunch of lords and anthem effects to make them bigger, and then it stopped. Their payoffs, their goals, their designs never evolved past huge board presence, now turn sideways, do I get there? Math is for blockers.
Right. A lot of times it wound up being, we would see cards less like, you would occasionally get something like Captain of the Watch, which is 4/2 white for a 3/3 creature human soldier. It has vigilance, it gives other creatures you control +1/+1 and vigilance, and it also makes 3/1/1 white soldier creature tokens. So it has a very easy way of manufacturing multiple bodies and then providing a buff onto those bodies. We would see this type of effect occasionally, but more often we would see more generic anthem effects, like Elesh Norn. Elesh Norn would be, you know, 5 white-white for a legendary creature Praetor, a 4/7 with vigilance, just flat. Other creatures you control get +2/+2, and creatures your opponents control get -2/-2. A lot more of what White wound up doing was just the global buff where it was kind of divorced from any particular tribe.
Yeah, and I think the key commander, I guess, that would kind of embody what White soldiers want to do, and this is, you pick your flavor here, but it would be either Odric, either Master Tactician or Lunok Marshal. And, you know, I'll go through both of them real fast, but, you know, sticking on theme, he is a mono white soldier. Odric Master Tactician is 2 generic white-white. First strike, whenever Odric Master Tactician or at least 3 other creatures attack, you choose how creatures block this combat, and it's a 3/4, which is great. It provides your little white soldiers a commander, a flavorful commander to follow on the battlefield into battle. And then you have Odric Lunark Marshal, which, surprise again, is a 4-mana white human soldier. At the beginning of each combat, creatures you control gain first strike until end of turn, if a creature you control has first strike. The same is true for flying, death touch, double strike, haste, hexproof, indestructible, lifelink, menace, reach, skulk, trample, and vigilance. So it pays for having some of the keywords that exist on soldiers. But at the end of the day, it still comes down to, we want to reward you for having as many bodies on the field as possible with keywords and turning them sideways and go. And that's what it's like to be a soldier.
Yeah, and even then, while I would agree, Odric does not specifically say soldiers matter anywhere in its rules text, you do see a lot of those, I won't even say a lot, you would see some of those come up occasionally on soldier cards, but they were really hard to truly make work, because some of those, I mean, you're kind of digging if you're looking for a mono-white death toucher.
Yeah.
Now, a little harder to make work.
Yeah. But finding things like First Strike and Vigilance on white soldiers and lifelink to an extent in white, not too much of a stretch. So there's a chance you could have a whole bunch of First Striking, lifelinking, vigilant soldiers just swinging in.
Right. So, which I think kind of leads into one of the questions we have to ask when we are looking at these tribes and if they're all created equal. And one of them, I guess, would be the opportunity cost. How much are you going to have to warp your deck building? What kind of deck building restrictions are you going to accept? You're already accepting one where a lot of your deck is going to be limited to this particular creature type. How much more of a deck building restriction does that commander in particular, or that tribe in particular, put on your deck building?
Well, if we're looking at Audric specifically, you get the question of, okay, so if I look at Audric and say, I want the full suite of these types on here, then you have two choices. You can give up Audric as a commander and have him in the 99 and get yourself a commander that has the colors that you want to give you those keywords, and then your goal is to draw to or tutor up or somehow get Audric into play and keep him in play. Or you start introducing things, once again Audric in mind, that give these abilities to creatures that do not necessarily fall into a creature type, and specifically in white it's equipment, more or less the case.
Yeah.
So you'd be using equipment or enchantments in some regard to give your creatures something they traditionally wouldn't have. So you can have artifacts that, you know, hey, are an equipment that, hey, all right, this creature has death touch. Well, now that it has death touch, the rest of them have death touch, or the rest of them have menace. And at that point in time, how much of your deck do you dedicate to just using equipment for these like effects? So it's one of those things, the proverbial, is the juice worth the squeeze kind of thing.
Right, right. And I think another thing we have to talk about then is enablers versus payoffs. So where Catapult Master, the first one that we discussed, is definitively just a payoff, if you have invested enough of your time and your effort to get the bodies on the board, now you can tap five of them to just start exiling creatures. Versus an enabler, which is a way to reach the thresholds you need in order to turn your deck on. Captain of the Watch, which we discussed a few moments ago, is kind of both of those things. But that is a rare thing in white, particularly in the soldier tribe, which provides you both lots of soldier bodies and buffs that those soldiers want.
And ultimately, when you try and pick something as there, like, I want soldiers, and like we keep going back to Audric because he's the preeminent, like, soldier commander, is you only have 99 slots. So how much of, like, what's the balance between too much or too little trying to make the enabler versus the payoffs work? And that, years into me playing Magic, I still have that issue where it's like, you know, if I can resolve XYZ, this is going to be awesome. Like, great, what do I do in the first two or three turns of the game while I'm trying to work towards this? And the issue that white runs into specifically on its own is that its early turns are really weak. So it's like, all right, So you get a turn two Elite Inquisitor, which is from the Innistrad block. It is just a human soldier, 2/2, first strike vigilance, and it has protection from vampires, werewolves, and zombies. Protection from someone's favorite tribes. But aside from that, it's just a 2/2 first striking vigilance. And that's cool, I guess, but it doesn't really do too much. Like, you get in for 2 damage to one of your opponents. You can get past their mana dorks because they can't block at the risk of losing it, and you've got a blocker that can turn sideways. But aside from that, it's not... It only moves your game forward simply by having a body on the field and some flavor text to it, but it doesn't help you get your goal done any faster.
Right, and then, like, if we look at edhrec.com, some of the highest synergy cards that they mention that are in mono-white, you see, like, Daru Warchief, which for 2 white-white, you have a 1/1 creature soldier, and soldier spells cost that you play cost 1 less to cast, and soldier creatures you control get +1/+2. So, yeah, it gives you a little bit of a Lord Anthem effect, but not particularly strong. And then other cards that are high synergy in that tribe, you have, like, Mentor of the Meek, which is undoubtedly a great card. 2 and a white for a 2/2 human soldier. Whenever another creature with power 2 or less enters the battlefield under your control, you may pay 1. If you do, draw a card. So there are some payoffs that exist within that tribe, but a lot of them are not really pushing you to play that tribe in the same way that some other tribes that we're going to discuss later do.
Yeah, and I guess this falls true for any of the tribes. Some of them have better payoffs than others, but if you're looking for any anthem effects or things of that nature, the three strongest anthems in the game that you could be applied towards anything that wants to go wide, Akroma's Memorial, or Memorial of Just Win the Game, didn't come out until Planar Chaos, or the Time Spiral block, way after Soldiers kind of became a thing. Eldrazi Monument, which gives all your creatures +2/+2 flying and indestructible at the cost of a soldier token, which you could be creating, didn't come out until Zendikar. And then you had Coat of Arms, which did come out in the Odyssey era of Magic.
Came out in Exodus.
Exodus. Which was the proverbial, okay, now if you have a meaningful number of creatures and you turn sideways, there's going to be a meaningful number on the other end of that in the double digits. Once again, none of those care about them being soldiers. They simply care about board presence. So you're not invested into playing soldiers. You're simply just invested to playing things onto the board. And these anthem-esque effects just push you the rest of the way.
Right. And I think board presence, we've identified, is one of the weaknesses that tribal has to pay.
Yeah.
You said before that, oh, well, that's the second wrath I've eaten. I'm kind of out of it, guys.
Yeah, and Wraths, becoming more so more prevalent in Black of the recent years, are pretty much common across all colors, green being the exception. When you sit down to a table running goblins or elves or pretty much any tribe that you want to run that doesn't have blue or doesn't have dedicated slots for indestructible or hexproof cards like Boros Charm come to mind, things of that nature, you're just one board wipe away from a bad day.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, R&D has recognized that, and we have seen more and more cards, particularly based in white, that allow you to save your board. Teferi's Protection being probably the biggest one, Boros Charm that you mentioned being another important one, but also cards like Flawless Maneuver out of the new Commander set, which again just gives you a way to protect your board temporarily, and then before that, Heroic Intervention. That one was in green, but you kind of get where I'm going with this. They kind of recognized that this was a potential weakness and gave some tools for a crafty pilot to be able to protect their board.
Yeah, and that just comes into the age-old question, does it deserve a slot? And ultimately, that's just up to you and your playgroup. Because if, you know, you sit down to a table and everyone's running, you know, here's a sign of the Ur-Dragon deck, and someone's playing Elves and you're playing Merfolk, and there's a Goblin player over there, or someone's playing Artifacts, the chances of you running into a Wrath go down. As compared to someone, you know, running dedicated, hey, I'm just going to start Cyclonic Rifting and Damnation. You know your playgroup and know exactly what you're expecting. And if you don't really expect a Wrath, then maybe you don't dedicate the slots to it. But I like to at least have at least one silver bullet in terms of, ha, gotcha, in my deck to keep my board alive. Normally it's Teferi's Protection.
Well, speaking of silver bullets, why don't we move then on to the next color around our color pie and talk about Tribes from Blue? And I think when we discussed this, we kind of agreed there's really just one tribe that is emblematic of blue.
And that is
a tribe that has a really interesting evolution.
It's Homunculus, right?
I think I was going to hold off on Homunculus until we got a proper Fibblethip deck, but...
Oh, so okay, so if it's not Homunculus, it probably has to be Merfolk then, right?
Yeah, let's go with Merfolk instead. Let's make Corbin Hostler just a little bit happier with his life. So, Merfolk actually kind of have the distinction of having one of the first proper lords in all of Magic with Lord of Atlantis. Lord of Atlantis being 2 blue mana for a 2/2 creature, originally just Lord, but since errated to a Merfolk Lord, which says other Merfolk you control get +1/+1 and have Island Walk. This was back in Alpha, the card was first printed. So it's been with us since the beginning of the game. So let's talk a little bit about lords. We talked about anthem effects before. What is the difference that a lord brings to the table?
Depends. I mean, the loaded question there is, depending on what color the lord is in. So Lord of Atlantis brought two things to the table. One, as a creature, it added to your board presence, always a positive. Mm-hmm. It did bolster your team, as lords do, the inspiration your champion has taken the field, normally giving your creatures +1/+1 or some, you know, boon to their attack and or defense. And then the added bonus of, well, now they have Island Walk. In the event that you're facing someone unfortunate to also have islands, your Merfolk are going to be sneaky fish, and they're just going to swim around the defenses and become unblockable.
And I think the part that was really important early on is the idea of this board presence, that the Lord of Atlantis also counted towards that board presence, and multiple Lords of Atlantis, they would buff each other too. So the Merfolk tribe continued to evolve into sets like Lorwyn, which was one of the next big tribal blocks in Magic, and we got cards like Merrow Reagery. Merrow Reagery is 2 and a blue for a creature Merfolk soldier, a 2/2. Other Merfolk creatures you control get +1/+1, and whenever you cast a Merfolk spell, you may tap or untap target permanent. So here we see a Lord. You pay a little bit more for the premium. It still has that Lord effect of buffing up all of its teammates. It provides that board presence, but it also staples on a very blue effect, which is something that really, as part of the tribe's evolving, and it's taking in more of the characteristics of its color and emphasizing them, it allows you to build your tribal deck in different ways to take advantage of different things.
Definitely. And Lorwyn, the Lorwyn block specifically, introduced a unique aspect to tribal that it previously didn't exist, and that is spells, instant sorceries, enchantments, with the tribal supertype.
Ah, the tribal supertype. You're getting the judge in me very excited at the moment.
And if any, I mean, and obviously if you're listening to us, you've played Commander, and more than likely you've sat down against a green player who at some point in time has resolved a Seedborn Muse against you, which pretty much immediately goes to the number one target on the table. With the tribal supertype added in the Lorwyn block, we got the gem in blue for Merfolk, Merrow Commerce, which is a 2-mana enchantment, 1 and a blue, and it is a tribal enchantment, Merfolk. And it simply reads, at the end of your turn, untap all Merfolk you control.
It's a powerful effect. We know that essentially having pseudo-vigilance, that's pretty nice. It's not quite as powerful in Merfolk as it might be in certain other colors and other tribes, but it still is a powerful effect. Now, Lorwyn also gave us a number of other additions to the tribe, which spoke pretty heavily as to what the color blue was evolving to be able to do. We had cards like Cursecatcher come out, Cursecatcher being a single blue mana for a 1/1 creature Merfolk Wizard. You can sacrifice Cursecatcher, counter target instant or sorcery spell unless its controller pays 1. Cards like this made splashes in 60 and 4 formats more so than Commander, where a 4 spike at the lower power levels tends to be a lot less effective, but it represents the tribe kind of branching out to be able to do things that you really need to be able to do while also providing that critical mass of bodies on the field.
And this was the first time that Merfolk branched into colors other than blue, with cards like Sig River Cutthroat giving you the card advantage that not only is synonymous with blue, but also black. So this was the first instance of a multicolor blue-black.
Right, and Sig River Cutthroat is 2 hybrid mana, either blue or black for either mana. This is a legendary creature, Merfolk Rogue. It is a 1/3, and at the beginning of each end step, if an opponent lost 3 or more life this turn, you may draw a card. So the tribe begins pushing into a slightly more aggressive stance while also emphasizing one of blue's abilities, drawing cards. This is a strong thing. There's also the modern Merfolk staple with Silvergill Adept, which was a card that... So it is 1 and a blue for a 2/2, a 2/1... excuse me, Merfolk Wizard. As an additional cost to cast Silvergill Adept, reveal a Merfolk card from your hand or pay 3, and then it cantrips when it enters the battlefield. When Silvergill Adept enters the battlefield, draw a card. These were kind of important building blocks to allow for that critical mass of creatures on the battlefield in modern Merfolk decks. While not something you see commonly in Commander, this was very different than the evolution we saw of Soldiers.
Indeed, and one of the interesting things about the storytelling of Lorwyn block is this plane that shifts between day and night. So if we've got Sig River Cutthroat being the blue-black hybrid, there it is. It's as known, slightly less useful blue-white counterpart in Sig River Guide. So not only did Merfolk branch off into one color, but 2 during the set. And while black is powerful in regards to what it can add, Merfolk didn't really hit their stride until we got to Ixalan.
Yeah, so in Ixalan, rather than going back to the well for blue or for black or for white as a supporting color, we instead branched out into green.
Which pretty much just makes Merfolk Simic, and you can do whatever it is you want to do. The world is your oyster.
Your moss-covered, gross, fungal oyster.
Yeah.
So once we got into green, and once we got into Simic, Ixalan brought us additional lords. We got cards like Merfolk Mistbinder.
Printed at Uncommon.
Merfolk Mistbinder is a green and a blue for a Merfolk Shaman 2/2. Other Merfolk you control get +1/+1. No additional frills, no additional... Well, actually, she's got quite a few frills on her. But this is more of a no-frills, bare-bones lord. Just make your creatures bigger. Again, we're getting that critical mass of different lords. At this point, I think Merfolk were up to like 4 or 5 lords below 3 CMC, which obviously made them fairly strong in modern. Well, relatively strong anyway, as far as tribal goes. But also, now we're starting to hit the levels we need to have a critical mass of cards that we can consistently draw into in Commander. But apart from just lords, there were some other powerful cards that came out of Ixalan once we started including green.
Yeah, so you got Kapala, Warden of Waves, which gave your merfolk elements of protection. A unique thing in blue, giving your creatures hexproof and evasiveness, but nothing super fancy for yourself. Nothing says, hey, you'd be great in the 99, but not necessarily in the command zone itself.
Yeah, Kapala being one blue-blue for a legendary creature merfolk wizard is a 2/2. Spells your opponents control that target a merfolk you control cost 2 more to cast, and abilities your opponents activate that target a merfolk you control cost 2 more to activate. Just a little bit of that additional protection to make spot interaction difficult for your opponents.
Indeed.
But there was a real superstar that came out of Merfolk branching into green in Ixalan.
So if you've read, for those of you here that have read the Ixalan story, the Ixalan block is divided into its Ixalan and then Rivals of Ixalan. And Ixalan proper, the first block, said, gave us Tishana, Voice of Thunder, which is very similar to Zagana back from the old Ravnica days. She's 7 mana, 5 blue and a green. When she enters, Tishana's power is equal to, and toughness are equal to the number of cards in your hand. You have no maximum hand size, and when Tishana enters the battlefield, draw a card for each creature you control. Very powerful, and it rewards you for having a board state. But that's not who we're talking about. When Rivals of Ixalan,
you want to talk about the other fishy.
When Rivals of Ixalan came out, and the Magic story was happening, there was a bit of a competition between Tishana and our next commander, Kumina, Tyrant of Orozca, which pretty much looked at Tishana and said, hold my beer. Kumina, Tyrant of Orozca is a 3-mana, 2/4, Merfolk Shaman with a small book of text. First, tap another untapped Merfolk you control. Kumina, Tyrant of Orozca, can't be blocked this turn. Alright, so you've got that evasiveness that exists in blue that Merfolk, that previous lords offered. Tap Merfolk you have. Tap a subordinate, the commander can get in there, get some damage in. Cool. Tap 3 untapped Merfolk you control. Draw a card.
There we go. There's
that
payoff.
There's that card draw in blue that, you know, you have that board state. And then just because the first two aren't enough, tap 5 untapped Merfolk you control. Put a +1/+1 counter on each Merfolk you control.
There we go. So we got our Lord effect. We got something that's powerful to just do in general in Commander in drawing cards.
And then at this point in time, we talked about cards that are good in a specific deck and then garbage elsewhere. Before the introduction of Kumina, Tyrant of Orozca, Mirror of Commerce giving you pseudo haste was kind of good.
But well, pseudo vigilance.
Pseudo vigilance.
With untapping your creatures at the end of each turn.
Was kind of good, not necessarily backbreaking. Mirror of Commerce with Kumina is backbreaking. It's,
yes, you can just tap your board down to refill your hand, and when you're happy with your hand, then you can just start throwing counters around on all your guys and.
And then, at the end of turn, untap it. It is worth noting that because Mirror of Commerce is a tribal enchantment merfolk, you can in fact tap it to pay for Kumina's costs.
That is correct, because it does not want you to tap a merfolk creature. It just says, tap a merfolk.
Yes.
And that enchantment is in fact a merfolk. Tribal is such a weird super type.
Yeah. Kumina is probably the best example we have. Second best example, my personal opinion going into what we're talking about today, of kind of how colors can evolve and become stronger as they mix. Mm-hmm. Kumina as a commander for a specific tribe, giving you access to multiple colors, is just straight busted.
It gives some very powerful effects, drawing on both aspects of the tribe from blue, and then the little bit we saw from green, where green gave us some fairly solid bodies for merfolk in the Ixalan block. I wouldn't say any of them are Commander All-Stars, but you could do a lot worse than some of the powerful merfolk you can get out of green. And honestly, you would probably do just fine to lean heavily, heavily into blue and just play a smattering of green merfolk.
I mean, as someone that prefers playing, like, I like most of my EDH decks to be tribal-esque because I enjoy the immersion fantasy of that. I would rather have three or four or five solid common, uncommon rares that fit a tribe than one ultra-busted card that just fits an archetype and the rest are just kind of duds. Luckily, Ixalan, the set, was the equivalent of adding, hey, Commander tribal players, do you want to go to a party? Oh, what's at that party? There's a pinata. What's in the pinata? A whole bunch of awesome for Commander, because it gave you merfolk, it gave you pirates, it gave you vampires, it gave you dinosaurs.
Yes, it did. So we kind of see in blue, compared to soldiers, we see merfolk kind of evolving and taking on some aspects that are really critical to making a good tribe in Commander, as opposed to simply being able to, I can interact. Blue brings in things like, yes, I can interact, and I can draw cards. We also saw cards like Seafloor Oracle, which was another gift from Ixalan block, where we had a 2 and 2 blue for a 2/3 creature merfolk wizard. Whenever a merfolk you control deals combat damage to a player, draw a card. So, hey, extra coastal piracy effect is always good. We had a lot of ways to turn your board presence into more resources, enabling you to build back up in the event that you did suffer one of those board wipes. This is something we didn't really see in white with those soldiers. But it is something that emphasizes the strengths of the color. It is something that we saw evolve as the tribe grew and R&D got more comfortable with how they were going to handle tribal.
And these merfolk evolved past their previous kin. They have legs and kind of look like beta fish.
Yeah, that was a little bit weird, but they've had legs for a long time now. I don't know what's up with that. I guess they didn't get the memo from Walt Disney.
She got legs too.
She got legs. Yeah, she didn't really know how to use them.
That's fair.
All right. So, Alex, do you have anything else to say about blue before we move on to a creepier, crawlier color?
We'll see more blue later on, actually in our next section. But let's move on to black.
Yeah. So, once again, going back to the beginning of Magic, I would say that the iconic tribe of black, it's zombies. We had a little discussion on whether it should be zombies or whether it should be vampires. I think vampires are more of a special case. And I just think that zombies have gotten so much love over the years, it would be hard not to talk about them in a tribal episode.
Yeah. And it's weird. As someone who, like myself, I'm very big on elves and tokens, it's weird to know that you kind of have to share the token pie with, of all things, zombies.
Well, zombies have always just, like, in popular culture, been that here's this teeming mass. So it seems like they were kind of tailor-made to be a swarm and thus tailor-made to be a tribe, because what do we keep coming back to? You need to have a board presence, and zombie tokens have always been such an easy way to do that. But black also is the color of reanimation, of getting things back out of the graveyard. And what crawls out of the grave better than a zombie?
Worms.
Sure, but what in Magic, what crawls out of the grave better than a zombie? The answer is nothing. Stop. Stop. But
skeletons. So,
black's part of the color pie has always been that black knows and understands how to just grind resources out of the graveyard. And zombies as a tribe very quickly came to, I guess, kind of abuse that, or at least utilize it as part of their identity. They also had a lord back in Alpha, Zombie Master. And Zombie Master is one black for a creature zombie. It is a 2/3. Other zombies you control have Swamp Walk, and other zombies you have the ability to pay black to regenerate this permanent. Not exactly the most powerful starting lord in all of Magic's history.
No, but black also, I think, can kind of take its place at the rightful top of the tier in terms of having the most lords or the most cards that pay off for synergy.
Oh, yeah. So black and zombies in particular, if you just do a search on like Scryfall or Gatherer for something that includes the word zombie as part of the text box on the card, let's see here. I have, how many is this? 193 cards that include the text zombie in their text box. A lot of them will be making zombie tokens. A lot of them will be letting you count the number of zombies you have. Some of them will let you take zombies out of your graveyard. Some of them will be letting you make more zombies out of other things. But just like a lot of the other tribes that we looked at, zombies got a boost during the first proper tribal set of Onslaught block with cards like Undead Warchief. 2 and 2 black mana for a 1/1 creature zombie. Zombie spells you cast cost 1 less to cast, so cheating on mana cost, plus zombie creatures you control get an additional +2/+1. So I think you and I would agree that having a boost to power with a tribe is much more powerful than having a boost to toughness.
Oh, definitely. The only thing that kind of beats either of those is a boost to evasion, I guess would be my thing. Mm-hmm. Which, it's funny enough, zombie tribes excel of that later on past the Onslaught Scourge block. when you get into later on.
Yeah, exactly. But the other advantage that zombies have over other tribes like merfolk is that you kind of always have new zombies showing up.
Yeah.
So zombies are just one of those creature types that will show up from time to time in different sets, even if that set is not a tribal set. Sometimes you will just happen to get a powerful zombie card. For example, looking back through Magic's history, I would not say that Khan's block was a particularly like tribe-heavy set, other than maybe dragons in Dragons of Tarkir. But Sidisi Brood Tyrant was a commander for 1 black, green, and blue, for a legendary creature Naga Shaman 3/3, and whenever it attacks or blocks, you mill yourself the top 3 cards off of your library, and whenever one or more creature cards are put into your graveyard from your library, you make a zombie token. Just incidentally, here, this is not a tribal set, but here is another tool for you if you want to play zombies.
And it wasn't till, and I mean that added a lot to it, but it wasn't until a bit later on where you started seeing more of zombies, and one thing that kind of just came to me as I'm looking at it and the different sets in which it appears, zombies, I mean, the way you just described it is, you know, what falls into that fantasy. And I think it's just kind of Americanized that we're just thinking of zombies as just zombies for what they are. One of the sets that kind of ties into that specifically, you know, maybe some European aspects is the Innistrad set, both the original Innistrad block,
yeah,
and Eldritch Moon and Return.
Yeah, so the original Shadows. Innistrad block, and then through Shadows Over Innistrad and Eldritch Moon.
Yeah, you're pretty much living a Lovecraftian gothic horror plane, where zombies are just everywhere. And it pulls from some high fantasy there. So some of the cards that kind of tie in most intrinsically to what zombies want to do came from that. In terms of lords, you have a Diagraph Captain, which is a generic. You're diving from black, you're adding blue in this case.
Mm-hmm.
1 blue, black. Death Touch. Other zombies you control get +1/+1, and whenever another zombie you control dies, target loses 1 life. So not only is your horde going out there and getting bigger, but when you take one of your horde down, well, you know what, they scratch or they bite whoever they're attacking to, and you ding them for 1.
Right, and that's even expanding into another part of Black's Color Pie, saying, I don't really care if you kill my creatures, I'm going to get them back anyway. Kill as many as you want. There'll always be more dead people.
Yeah, and the next card doesn't actually have anything to do with zombies per se. It's not in the name of the card. And if you look at the art, it also has nothing to do with zombies. Realistically, it's more Frankenstein. That's Rooftop Storm. It's a 6-mana enchantment from the original Innistrad. You may pay 0 rather than pay the mana cost for zombie spells you cast. So you stick this with 6 mana, and then all zombies have a free casting cost. Fantastic. Life is great. which is a unique aspect, you know, completely reducing the cost of your zombies in blue was an interesting turn, but a staple in any deck that runs it. And then we get into kind of the newer Eldritch Moon Shadows of Innistrad that gives you one of the, I would say, best new cards for it in the form of Cryptbreaker. It's just a 1/1 zombie. Its first ability is 1 and a black tap, discard a card, put a zombie onto the battlefield, and it's just a 2/2 zombie. But taking a page out of Kumina's book here, tap 3 untapped zombies you control, you draw a card and lose life, which is fantastic in and of that. And then obviously you have Endless Ranks of the deck, yeah.
they just play into exactly what the tribe and the colors want to be doing. And these are cheap, powerful payoffs for what the tribe already wants to do.
Now, one thing I did mention before, that the term zombie is, I guess, Americanized and some European. But another set that had a lot of zombie influence, of all things, was Amonkhet. And while zombie is a type, the more apt term should probably have been mummy, which are essentially zombies. But
I would have been really, really mad if they made a set full of Walking Dead and turned them into mummies instead and divided the tribe further.
Yeah, but
fortunately, they did not.
But it's just one of the things I didn't think about, where it's like, all right, well, you know, zombies are what we call them. It's what, you know, we've been inundated with mainstream media about the undead, things like the Walking Dead, you know, coming to Magic Gur. But, I mean, mm-hmm. you've got, you know, mummies in the way of, you know, Egyptian. Coming out next year, we have Kaldheim. So we have the chance of having Draugr, which are, mm-hmm. fun fact, we now have Norse mummies. So.
Well, we might. We don't know what's in that set yet, but I wouldn't be surprised. I honestly, at this point, I'd be more surprised if there was a set that did not have any zombies in it, as opposed to a set that did have zombies in it. And really, before we dig into Amonkhet proper with some of the powerful cards that zombies as a tribe got out of that set, we have to mention that zombies being such a ubiquitous tribe where merfolk are a lot less common, there are just cards that are incidentally good that happen to be zombies that you want to run anyway. Like a lot of black decks that are going to be abusing the graveyard are going to be happy to run a card like Fleshbag Marauder. Two and a black for a 3/1 creature zombie. When Fleshbag Marauder enters the battlefield, each player sacrifices a creature. It's just a powerful effect for any deck that's going to be recycling the graveyard, and the fact that it also happens to be a zombie that your deck might have an even easier time getting back. That's something that this tribe is really strong with.
Yeah, it's the Meryn Clan Neltoths of the world.
Exactly. So let's dig into our Amonkhet block. What happened here with zombies, with moving into white?
They got some fun keywords. So out of all the zombies that kind of impacted EDH from Amonkhet, most of them are uncommon. A conversation can be made for the Scarab Lord. The Scarab mm-hmm. God was significantly scarier in Constructed Limited than it was in Commander.
I agree. It's still a cool commander. It's probably one of my favorite zombie commanders. It has a nice payoff built into it, but it doesn't really need a zombie deck built around it to get to that payoff. Just its activated ability to be able to pay two and a blue and a black to just rip the best cards out of someone's graveyard and turn them into 4/4 zombies on your side of the battlefield, and then being able to drain each opponent for X life and scry X, where X is the number of zombies you control, on a basically unkillable commander. Yeah, that's strong. It doesn't necessarily need to have a zombie army built around it. It builds its own.
Yeah, but if you want to have some similar effects at a much cheaper, much easier to pull and or purchase price, you have Wayward Servant. It's just a black-white for a 2/2 zombie. Whenever another zombie enters the battlefield under your control, each opponent loses one life, you gain one life.
So classic Soul Sister, classic Aristocrat, and just so happens to be on a relevant tribe in a slightly new color. But we also got some other powerful cards from the Amonkhet block sticking just in black. Oh, what was the name of the other zombie
Lord of the Accursed. Lord of the Accursed.
You read my mind, Alex.
And it's just nice and simple. 3 mana for a 2/3. It's mono black. Other zombies you control get +1/+1. Great. Fantastic. 1 and a black tap it. All zombies gain menace until end of turn. So.
Oh, menace is one of those just underrated and powerful effects. Menace, you can't be blocked. You have to be blocked by two creatures if you have menace. You would be surprised just how effective that is as an piece of evasion.
Yeah, that's... It's one of my more, like, I guess, desired traits when I'm looking for stuff like that. Like, mm-hmm. I have a, we'll get into it later on, but like a vampire deck with Edgar Markov at the helm. Menace is a huge theme of that deck because it just makes attacking that much more profitable and, I guess, easier to commit to when you know that, hey, you can't do as profitable blocking as you normally would.
Yeah, exactly. Now, one of the once we got through the Amonkhet block with all the goodies that we got from white, where we really got rewarded for going wide, Wizards fairly quickly, I think within a year, they gave us a pretty powerful commander for this new Esper identity for for zombies.
Varina.
Yeah, Varina the Lich Queen. She is one, a white, a blue, and a black for a 4/4 creature zombie wizard. Whenever you attack with one or more zombies, draw that many cards, then discard that many cards. You gain that much life. You can then pay 2, exile 2 cards from your graveyard, create a tapped 2/2 black zombie creature token. So again, she is both an enabler and a payoff. Probably leans a little bit more towards payoff than enabler, but zombie decks are very happy to get cards in graveyard. Looting is a very good way to do that. And the fact that she bolsters your life total is just kind of gravy at that point while she's helping you sculpt your hand. And she lets you use cards that are otherwise kind of useless in the graveyard for Esper, like land cards or already used instants and sorceries, and turn them into more bodies.
And that's why I think that even though there are tons of notable mentions for commanders that are zombies, Ghoulcaller Geesa, which is strong, obviously Micaeus, which, you know, Micaeus.
Yeah, he's more of a combo commander anyway.
Yeah.
But then things like Grimgrin is another classic one.
Scarab God.
Geesa and Giralf, when they teamed up together.
But I do think Varina is kind of the final form of what Zombie Tribal wants to do. It encourages you for attacking, encourages you for that reanimator concept, and realistically, it gives you relevant colors.
Right.
And kind of tapping on blue a little bit in this case, you know, coming out of something that you would not expect to be a zombie set, but surprise, it was a zombie set, War of the Spark. Because, you know, the invading army was, surprise, all zombies. And that gave you, it is Gleaming Overseer. It is just a 1/4 for 3, 1 a blue and a black. Gleaming Overseer enters the battlefield, amass 1. Amass is a mechanic where you put a +1/+ counter on an army you control. If you don't have an army, you create one. It's a 0/0 black zombie token. That's a fun wall of text. It's kind of irrelevant. What matters is zombie tokens you control have hexproof and menace.
Why, you cut out at the end there. What is the other thing it gives? It gives hexproof?
Hexproof and menace. So
there you go. There's that evasion.
So, and then you've got things like Cover of Darkness, which also gives, you know, fear, menace, things of that nature. And the, I guess the notable inclusion of, just because you're a zombie doesn't mean you need to be in a zombie deck. Can you guess which 5-mana fiddle-playing merchant I'm talking about?
Oh, Gary. Gray Merchant of Asphodel.
Yeah.
3/2 black for a 2/4 zombie with... when it enters the battlefield, you drain each opponent for X life, and you gain that much life, where X is your devotion to black. Again, just a good, powerful finisher in general, but an easy finisher for a lot of zombie decks, even those that are leaning on zombie tokens to do most of their dirty work.
Yep, it's just, do you play black? Great. Do you have a board presence? Great. Here's Grey Merchant of Asphodel.
And if you're not winning the game off the back of that, you're at the very least putting yourself in such a position that you probably will pretty soon.
And this brings us to one of the kind of talking points of the video, because we're almost at the hour mark. Well, you know, and Tribal's noteworthy to talk about. There are some cards that exist in Tribal that we just may not be able to get to. Zombies are an absolutely massive tribe. And we're only going up from here. If we started on the small scale with soldiers and merfolk and zombies, then you have to imagine what's coming up in red and green. But just because we don't necessarily mention them doesn't mean that they don't find their place in, you know, tribal decks for that. There are just so many zombies that do so much that it's hard to sit there and give them all notable mention.
Absolutely. Well, that was a bit of an abrupt stop, wasn't it? No big surprise that when you get Alex and I talking about a subject we both really enjoy, we can really talk about it. So what we thought was going to be one great episode of talking about Tribal has since sprawled into 2 episodes talking about Tribal. So be sure to tune in 2 weeks when we continue our talk about Tribal, starting with red, with green, and a few other special surprises, including a challenge that Alex has managed to set up for himself. So be sure to join us next time. Until then, I'm John, this is Gemstone Mine, we'll see you again soon. You can reach the crew from Gemstone Mine on Twitter at GemstoneMineMTG, or send us an email at GemstoneMinePodcast@gmail.com. On YouTube, we're Gemstone Mine Podcast. Be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell.